Okay, so first I'd like the organizers for the opportunity to talk. Secondly, I'd like to apologize for giving the first non-Blackboard talk. But at the same time, at least in some talks, I felt like the formulas were too long and it was just taking too long to write the formulas without enough time for explanations. So I'd like to avoid this. So this talk is going to be based on two papers that I did with my student Jos Hoeven. One appeared last year and one is about to appear. So in this talk I would like to discuss two topics. The first is the BRC derivation of the minimal and non-minimal amplitude prescriptions for the pure spinor superstring. And this is the subject of the paper from last year. And in the second part I will discuss a new type of BRST anomalies. I will show you that BRST exact states do not decouple in the minimal formalism. So feel free to stop me at any point. So first I will start by briefly reviewing the main points, so you have in mind what are these two prescriptions. There was some discussion of the non-minimal amplitude prescription, but I think so far there was no real mention of the minimal one, so I'll start by reviewing this, and then we'll go on and try to derive those. So let's start first with a very brief discussion of the minimal pure spinor formalism. So there are four things I want you to remember. So first of all, okay, this is the action. So the target space is the n-dimensional superspace times the pure spinor space. Secondly, this action here is invariant under a fermionic nilpotent symmetry, which is generated by QS. And for most of the talk, I'm not going to call this BRST symmetry because we're going to introduce a different BRST operator later on. Secondly, the cohomology of this operator at Gauss number one reproduces the superstring spectrum. And finally, the center charge of this theory is zero. So these are the four things. So now if you want to compute scattering amplitudes, there are two known prescriptions. Both of them were developed by Nathan in 2004 and 2005. So the first is the minimal prescription. So you basically need three different ingredients. First, you need vertex operators, so you need unintegrated ones, which satisfy this relation, and integrated ones, which are built out of V1s. And V1 and V0 are related through this relation. Secondly, you need so-called picture raising and lowering operators, which are constructed using a number of constant spinors and tensors. So we need 11 constant spinors and 11G constant anti-symmetric tensors. Then you construct these objects over here. And finally, we need a picture raised B field, namely a composite operator which solves this equation. So now if you have these three ingredients, then the amplitude prescription is the following. First of all, at tree level, we integrate, so we use three unintegrated ones, and the rest are integrated vertex operators, so and we insert 11 of those operators. So this, the first line looks familiar for people that are familiar with bosonic string, like the bosonic string prescription. This second line looks unfamiliar, and we'll see where it comes from. So when we go to loops, then we need to insert one of those picture-raised big ghost, and then there is a string of the other picture-changing operators. And, okay, we still have, let's say, the 11 of those. And we need, so for genus G, we need G of, this type over here. And you need a number of the other ones. And this, range of the indices looks somewhat unintuitive, and we'll see where it comes from. Okay, so that's the prescription. So if you're given these elements, you plug them in, and you do your computation. Now, the non-minimal formalism was discussed a little bit more the first week. So in this case, we need to introduce a couple of more ingredients. We introduce another pure spinor, which is meant to be the complex conjugate of the original one, and the fermionic constraint spinor R beta. They satisfy these relations. and in addition to that, the conjugate momentum. Then the action is shifted by a simple term, and the DRST operator also by that term. And because of the structure of the DRST operator, nothing in the cohomology of the new QS operator is independent of the non-minimal variables. In particular, we have the same fact we had for the minimal, namely the DRST cohomology of this operator at cost number one is just the superstring spectrum. Now to compute scattering amplitudes, again we need three different elements. First is again vertex operators, which is the same as before. Secondly, we change the picture changing operators, are now replaced by a so-called regularization factor, which is given by an expression of that type. This is built using the new, non-minimal variables as well as the minimal variables. Over here, the Barth variables and the S's are constructed using non-minimal fields, and this index I, which is constructed from this guys over here, is just taking the zero mode part of the corresponding object. And the same thing for over here. So here I included a small zero to indicate that you start from this composite operator and then you construct the zero mode.
Is this non-local on the world sheet because it's constructed out of the zero modes?
So this only depends on the zero.
It's not local, it's not manifestly modular invariant.
So as soon as you vary it, it's DRST true.
So you will see where it comes from, and also you will see whether any issues with it. But part of this talk is to explain where this comes from. So now given those, then we also need a composite B field, which now is like the normal B field. Satisfy this equation. There's nothing else on the right hand side, and then the amplitude prescription looks a little bit more familiar. Again, look like bosonic string amplitudes. Namely, for three level, we have three unintegrated, and the rest are integrated vertex operators. And the only new thing is that we need to include this this regularization factor. And at G loops. So you will see later on when I will derive it. So the original motivation was because you would see the certain infinities in your computation. You need to do something with it, with them. And one way to deal with them was to introduce that one. I mean, it absorbs zero inputs. But through this talk, I mean, this is the main part of the talk to explain why you need this factor and why this looks so similar to bosonic string. Why all of this? I want to explain precisely all the factors that appear over here. Okay, so these are the prescriptions. So any question about the actual prescriptions, not the meaning? Okay. So the plan of the talk is to derive this scattering amplitudes from first principles. And our point of view is different than most work was done previously. So we do not try to arrive at the pure spinner sigma model by, gauge fixing some other description. And then after you gauge fix, the ghosts become the pure spinners. Instead, we start with the original sigma model. And we consider this as a matter sigma model. So that's our starting point. With target space, 10-dimensional superspace times the pure spinner space. So this is not a string theory, it's just a sigma model. So now if we want to construct the string theory, we just need to couple this theory to two-dimensional gravity and then DRST quadize the system. So in particular, because this matter system has C equals zero, this means that the two-dimensional gravity must be topological, otherwise the system would be anomalous. So that's the strategy. So let's see how to do this. So the first step is to couple this to topological gravity. So to do this, we first need to relax the conformal gauge because the action was given in the conformal gauge. So this is fairly straightforward. There is one small technicality. So the first term, of course, is completely standard. And then the other two are slightly non-standard. So the p's and the thetas, or the w's and the lambdas, are 1,0 systems. So this is a vector on the worksheet and a spinner in target space, same thing over there. But these systems are chiral systems, so we don't necessarily have the, let's say, the anti-chiral sector. So this means that if we want to covariantize this action, we first have to, let's say, we introduce this projector that projects. So this vector here that would normally have Z and a Z-bar component, so we don't want to have that guy, and that's what this projection over here does. So this projects into a, so if you have a general vector, just projects into the component when you go to the conformal gauge.
This is on half of the action? This is on the
This is on half of the action. Throughout the talk, I will discuss half of the action, and there is a mirror image for the other half. So after you do this, after you introduce this operator, then it's straightforward to covariantize this. Okay? So this is a coupling of the pure spinner to gravity. It's not yet topological. So for the gravity to be topological, we need that the Washit metric is also transforms to the corresponding field. So you need to introduce such a transformation rule. But now once you introduce such a transformation rule, this action over here is not invariant under that, so we have to correct that. And one can correct this by simply adding one term.
What was QS?
QS is the fermionic, what Nathan calls BRST symmetry. Okay.
What's the S stand for?
Sigma model. Actually, the terminology comes more from, let's say, earlier papers on topological strings, where they had the QS, which was the BRST operator of the sigma model, and QV, which was the BRST symmetry of the topological sigma model coupled to topological gravity. And we will use the same, we follow the same notation. Okay, so this action would be invariant on QS, provided there exists a composite field GAB, which satisfies this relation. Okay, so at this point we have constructed an action, which is we have constructed a coupling of the pure spinner to topological gravity. But what we're really interested is in scattering amplitudes, and there is a neat way to incorporate this in the discussion from the beginning. So to do this, we're going to introduce sources of val weight 1 that couple to vertex operators, and then we modify the action by adding this piece over here. And then this object over here is going to be the generating functional of scattering amplitude. So if I differentiate with respect to rho and then set rho to 0, we're just going to bring down one of the v's. And this talk is about really explaining what is the meaning of this measure. Now, once we constructed this, we still want to have something which is QS invariant. So now the action that I constructed over here depends on the positions of these vertex operators as well as their QS partners. And since this is fermionic, this V has an expansion of that form. And using this BRC transformation, we see that in order for this action, curly S to be QS invariant, we need this V0 and V1 to satisfy this relation. So this is item 1 in the prescriptions. Okay, so now let's summarize what we've done so far. So we have obtained an action S, which depends on all original fields, the Washit metric and QS partners, as well as the position of the vertex operators ZI and their partners, which I'm going to consider as constant fields, like quantum mechanical variables, as well as the sources rho. So this action here is QS invariant, and it's also invariant under local diffeomorphisms and light transformations. So if we go gauge fix to we can gauge fix this to go back to the original point, but now we have an action which has this property. So this is our starting point. So
where does QS come from? Part of the specification?
Or it's part of the original sigma model. And the reason for starting from that sigma model is because the BRST cohomology of that operator is the superstring spectrum.
But you can't see arising as some sort of gauge fixing?
No, that doesn't arise as a gauge fixing. So it's part of the original data.
How does QS act on the original fields?
Yes, so it's just the pure spinner. Yes, exactly. So QS is lambda alpha d alpha. Yes.
What happens when you act with QS on the Wilshire curve?
You have a transformation also of the G, the metric.
So I gave you the BRC transformation, right? That's okay. You can construct it from here.
There is no
additional. It's standard procedure. You have any conformal field theory with C equals zero, with Q operator, which is a symmetry which squares to zero. And the stress energy tensor is Q exact. It's a standard procedure. How you couple it to topological gravity. And you can do it with C ghosts if you like. You can do it without C ghosts.
No, I mean, yeah, I'm not, yeah, this is, I'm just following a standard procedure. It's yes.
Q, which is pure spinner Q, you get what process has. And Q, which is a topological Q operator, is a topological spin.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
But this is not the disk operator that supplements this information. I mean, you need another piece.
Okay.
To do the Q of G equal to sum.
No, sure. So, yeah, I need another piece to add here to, yes, yeah.
The piece which seems unusual is the Q acting on the positions of the vertex operators.
Yeah, this is also unusual, but at the same time, it does...
varying the position of the point is the same as varying the metric. So
it's
the model,
yeah.
How does Q act on the position of Z?
So here it is.
No, that's on the position of the vertex operators, but on the coordinates. Does it act on that?
No, it doesn't act on that. So this I'm going to consider. So one unusual feature here is that I'm considering the positions of the vertex operators as additional constant fields. And you will see later on that this automatically leads to the, let's say, appropriate insertions of, let's say, integrated or unintegrated vertex operators. I mean, this is also not complete. I think.
New ghosts for the diffeomorphisms.
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
So this is when acting on positions of the vertex operators equivalent to change the metric.
Yeah, so let me move on because maybe some of this will be clear as I move on. If not.
This doesn't tell us what big G is, right?
Big G, I didn't tell you what yet what it is. So I just told you that it has to satisfy this relation, and I'm going to return to that, to this equation later on. I say, you know, provided that there is such a G, then this procedure makes sense. And I'm going to return to this. So now I'm going to be able to quantize. So we have an action that has local invariance under Wolschik diffeomorphisms and valid transformations. So we can just follow the standard BLST rules to quantize the system. So the one perhaps unconventional feature is that the BLST treatment, I'm going to include gauge invariances due to zero mode. So let me briefly explain this. So if we have zero modes, this means that there is an invariance of the action where the fields are just shifted by the zero mode. And because of that, the path integral is not well defined. So one has to deal with those. So typically, we deal with those a posteriori. Then we see what kind of insertions we should do in the path integral in order to make it well defined and see whether this, let's say, is consistent with the symmetry we started from. So here, we're going to deal with those from the beginning. So we're going to treat with these gauge invariances by using the Batalin-Wilkowski quantization scheme. And we need to use that because these are typical invariances of the ghost action. So there is, like, if you shift the anti-ghost by zero mode, this is an invariance. And for that, you need to use, for the F-Popov is not sufficient for this, for invariances of the ghost action. So this... So using this BV quantization scheme, dealing with these invariances amounts to introducing a gauge fixing condition, constant ghost, ghost for ghost, extra ghost, etc. And these are constant fields because we just shift this by the zero mode. So let me, you mean... So you, I think I will discuss. So, for instance, if you have fermionic zero modes, and if the vertex operators depend on these fields, then this is not an invariance of this full action. Yes. So this is a case where you shouldn't fix that zero mode.
Like translation symmetry.
So that can be treated exactly the same way, like this. Yeah. I'm not going to discuss it here, but it can be treated exactly the same way. So in the case of, one can follow, let's say, this procedure in the case of the bosonic string, and this leads very straightforwardly to the usual scattering amplitude prescription with all the correct pathetical insertions. And in this language, the metric moduli themselves are fields that you introduce in the process of quantization. They are so-called, they are identified with the extra ghost. So the extra ghost are the fields that you, the ghost you need to introduce if the anti-ghost has zero modes. So in that case, you have to include also ghost for ghost to deal with the zero modes of the ghost field.
So that the gauge works single model, you're going to gauge fix the fermionic isometries, and so you're not going to get a vanishing cosmological constant anymore?
So I'm going to gauge fix the zero modes of the ghost field if I would do... Not of the matter field.
You have to know which are matter and which are
Well, I mean, special cases, one has to think them through. But
can you explain a little more what do you mean by metric moduli becoming ghosts?
Maybe it will become apparent in one or two slides later, and then I'll explain more if it's not.
This is related to the fact that you're doing this topological.
No, it's not, because this paper over here from 2005 just dealt with standard bosonic string. It has nothing to do with topological string. One can use the same test for either bosonic or RNS. Actually, maybe at some point I will do it for RNS as well. Okay, actually I will explain this in this slide. So now to maintain the QS symmetry in the process of quantization, we need to introduce ghost and anti-ghost in QS pairs. So then, after we introduce all of these fields, then we do gauge fixing. And the gauge fixing terms are types. First of all, this fixes, let's say, local diffeomorphisms and Wahl transformations. So this condition here, so this G hat is a reference metric and depends on moduli. So this is precisely, so here I'm considering this moduli as the extra ghosts. And if you follow the BV discussion, they appear exactly at the place where the extra ghost would appear. And then you integrate over moduli not because... So the logic is not the usual logic that you fix the metric and you still have an unfixed part and then you have to integrate over different equivalence classes. But you gauge fix everything and then you integrate over all fields that you have to introduce in the process of gauge fixing. So in particular, this has to be introduced over here because the anti-ghost will have zero modes, and that's why you have to introduce the moduli. And then if you go through the procedure, then you find exactly the right measure for the path integral, in particular the B-field insertions.
What was QV again?
QV is now the standard BRST operator that you get, we have for diffeomorphisms and Wahl transformations.
So why isn't everything sort of all added together in one big BRST operator? Why is there a product?
So QS here was the BRST operator of the sigma model. So this is like global symmetry from my perspective. It's not doesn't come from gauge fixing something. So this QV is what you get when you BRST fix the diffeomorphisms and Wahl transformations. And the reason they appear as a product is because I want to maintain QS invariance in the process. So I want the gauge fixed version to still have the same global symmetry. And this does this, and this type of gauge fixing has that feature. This is also standard in, let's say, in topological string discussions.
Well, I guess I don't understand the standards, because I thought the standard way to do BRST is just take all your BRST objects, add them all together. It's one big BRST operator. The cohomology you get from the cohomologies of each of the terms, because it's separable, and you can't do that here. You can't just add QV plus QS and find some other expression that gives some equivalent result.
This is QV times QS. It is also QV plus QS times QS.
Yes. So from that perspective, yeah. But here I treat really differently the QS and the QV. So QS is like global symmetry. If you don't want to think of it...
Yeah, but wasn't your whole point of view that you introduced just a minute ago was that the zero modes would be treated the same as any other gate?
Yeah, so QV... Oops, sorry. QV also acts on the moduli, acts on tau and acts on everything. QV acts on everything.
Right, but now you're doing the opposite. You're separating them out instead of treating them on the same footing.
But they're two different symmetries, right? They're two different BRST operators. One is a global symmetry and the other is a BRST.
You have like gravitational symmetry and you have Yang-Mills symmetry. Your BRST operator is just the sum of the BRST for those two things. It's different, but...
But that one didn't arise as gauge fixing something, at least not in a way that we know. So it's not, I wouldn't call it, it's just a fermionic... It's a fermionic nilpotent symmetry. It's like starting from a supersymmetric model and twisting it, and then you get something that squares to zero just because originated from a supersymmetry.
The question is, what is your criterion for the physical states? So, what are the physical states annihilated?
So they.
QV plus QS.
Yes, they're annihilated by QV plus QS. Yeah.
Is there?
Yeah. So I didn't think it's just notational. Like you said, it could just be QV plus QS times, and then okay.
Okay, so this is the standard gauge fixing for the metric, but in addition, if we have conformal Killing vectors, we have additional zero mode invariances that we also have to gauge fix. So this is done by this term. So these are some reference positions. And, okay, these are the usual the positions. And again, we add this. So with this two terms, we deal with all gauge invariances except with the ones associated with the zero modes of the original fields. So now after you have this, then you expand these expressions. There are lots of fields that you need to introduce, but it turns out that all of the fields that are introduced in this BRST quantization appear at most quadratically in the field, and then one can explicitly integrate them out. So this is, you know, a few pages algebra, but you know, you follow through it, and that's the answer. So, so we see that cap of the vertex operator should be the unintegrated ones, and the rest should be integrated. This just comes out by integrating out these auxiliary fields. Then you need an insertion of this G field, and an integral over the moduli. This was the integral over the extra ghost that now you recognize as the integral over the moduli. And I still have to deal with the zero modes of the original fields. So at this point, all of this discussion would apply equally well to, let's say, topological sigma models coupled to topological gravity, and explains why the prescriptions that people use are so similar to bosonic string. I mean, they're exactly the same as a bosonic. I mean, this is a derivation from first principles. So,
is this whole structure exists for different genus and it's completely different for every genus? Or?
Here I've done all genuses at once.
Sort of how many ghost fields or how many...
Yeah, this of course, yes. Yes, this depends. Yeah, sure. Because the number of zero modes is different for the different genera.
So it's not a structure that applies for everything at the same. You apply once at a time.
You just have a different index, right? You have a Gauss field that has an index, and then this index runs over different values depending on which genus you are. So you can. It is exactly the same procedure. You just change the range of the index depending on the genus of the worksheet. So now let's discuss. Let's discuss these guys. So again, the pure spin or path integral measure will be determined by using BRST BV quantization treatment of the zero mode gauge invariances.
So you have spin two bosonic moduli, spin two fermionic moduli. Is there any reason? So you have to choose some Fichtmiller parameters for them both, or some moduli for them both on the GSG surface.
I mean, I have the I mean, it's a usually exactly the same story as in the bosonic string. There's no difference. The psi is going to be, it appears linearly, it is integrated out.
So, but when you integrate it out, you pull down factors of g or something
you,
like that?
You pull out this. This insertion comes from that.
Right. So my question is there any reason why the two, so when you do that, the two are somehow the same, right? The moduli for the b ghost is the same as the moduli for the psi ghost.
Yeah, there is a technical reason. You can see they appear in the same way.
They
yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this comes from the actually, if you follow through this derivation, you also introduce a usual B ghost, and there is a corresponding, let's say, QS partner, which is, let's say, beta, and then all of this just cancel out at the end because they appear in pairs.
Okay, so they have to be the same place.
Yes. I mean, it's not a difficult derivation. It's just going to take, half an hour writing on the blackboard.
I'm just asking if there are other gauge choices in which they don't appear in the same place. But you say they always appear in the same
yes,
place.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So gauge invariances due to fermionic zero modes are not very important in this context. And the reason is that the vertex operators provide the required zero modes so that the path integral is non-vanishing. So these are not really invariances of the full action. And to some extent, the same is true for bosonic non-compact zero modes, except for bosonic zero modes, except when they are non-compact. Because if they are non-compact, this means that when you try to do the path integral, then you're going to get an infinity because of the non-compactness of the zero modes. And the reason is that in this case, the action does not provide the convergence factor because of the zero-mode gauge invariance. You don't have a quadratic piece in the action when you do the path integral. So that's why you have to gauge fix the non-compact bosonic zero modes. So now let's see what kind of zero modes we have. So recall that on a genus G surface, if we have a Wachit scalar, this has one zero mode. And if we have a Wachit vector, we have G zero modes. So in total, we have 10 for the x's and 11 for the lambdas. And I have 11 G's for the Gaussian momenta of the lambdas. And this I'm going to trade for zero modes of the Lorentz current and the Gauss current. So 10 G of those are going to come from zero modes of the Lorentz currents and G of those from zero modes of the Gauss current. And one can show that this can be done. Now the gauge fixing, so first of all, the treatment of X zero modes is standard, can be done in this fashion, but can also be done the way it was done, say, 20 years ago. So here I'm going to discuss only the zero modes because of the pure spin of fields. So to deal with those, we just introduce this gauge fixing fermion, where these B's here are corresponding anti-ghosts. Now, if you process this, then you find that ghost and anti-ghost can be integrated out because, again, they appear in pair. One is fermionic and the other is bosonic. And one is left with this expression. So in this expression, the blue fields are so-called BRST auxiliary fields, which impose gauge fixing conditions. So over here, in writing down this expression, I have already committed into a gauge fixing condition. So typically, you're going to have pi imposing some gauge fixing condition. And this gauge fixing condition, for me, is, for instance, for the first part over here, is that this is just lambda alpha. And we will see that part of the, let's say, issues with the problems with understanding better the pure spinor amplitudes come from the fact that one is using this gauge fixing condition. But I will explain this as we go on. So,
is this compatible with SL density?
Yes.
What is the way to choose 11 components of the spinor?
So that's actually the next 10 slides or so. Okay. Yeah. So here, this have to be 11. This have to have 11 independent components because we need to impose 11 conditions for the 11 zero modes of the lambdas. This we need because of the QS invariance. So in a sense, this is dictated by the fact that we want a quantization which is QS invariant. And this, again, are imposes Tenji conditions for the Tenji zero modes of the conjugate momentum, and this is the remaining G. Okay, so now we're going to study this action, and we're going to treat it in two different ways. So first, I'm going to discuss the non-minimal, how this matches the non-minimal formulation. Now, this auxiliary fields pi and pi tilde have exactly the same properties as the zero modes of the non-minimal variables lambda bar and r alpha. Namely, they have exactly the same components and exactly the same QS transformations. So at this point, one can identify those. And exactly the same is true for the other. So the n bars and the s's that I introduced in the beginning when I review what is the non-minimal prescription can be identified with this BRST auxiliary fields. So with this identification, this regularization factor is exactly equal to the gauge fixing Lagrangian. It's exactly equal to that. Okay, so that explains that factor. So now let's go back to the equation for G. So in this case, one can show that this equation has a solution of that form. And then using that, we arrive exactly at the non-minimal scattering amplitude prescription. So we have precisely all elements. However, this quantity over here has poles as lambda lambda bar go to zero. And there are potentially problems there. So let me review this. This was discussed a bit in the first week. So once we have this non-minimal fields, then there exists a field psi, which has anti-commutator with QS equals to 1, and this diverges as lambda lambda bar to the minus 11. So this means that if we allow singular behavior of that form, then all QS closed operators would actually be exact because of this well-known construction. So this means that one must make sure that that the theory has no operators who diverge with this rate. And furthermore, a related issue is that if you look at the path integral, if you just put in the insertions, one finds that if the insertions diverge faster than this, then there would be infinities in the path integral. And this can only happen for a genus greater than 2. So that prescription seems to be well-defined up to genus 2.
You can get these at genus 0 if you choose to use just, if you do an endpoint amplitude with unintegrated vertex separators. I mean, it must happen for genus 2 greater than 2, but it can also happen for G less than 2.
You mean there may be problems at lower genus?
Yeah, so if you just say, if you give an endpoint amplitude and you put egos not on top of the vertex operators,
But we've just derived that you just have to insert one big cost. Well, you know,
So what Nathan is saying is that you, instead of using integrated vertex operator, you could use unintegrated vertex operator as a B, which will come.
But I'm not using that though, right?
No, that shows that this singularity could be just an artifact.
Sure. But I mean, if it is an artifact, if you can remove it, okay, you can.
That means that there is no singularity.
Yes, right. Yeah. Okay, so let's go back here. So to avoid this problem, so one way to deal with this problem is to go back to this equation, and then observe that this equation really defines a cohomology class of G. It doesn't define G by itself. So one can start looking for a different representative that is less singular, because if you find something which is less singular, then you won't have that problem. And such a construction has been discussed by Nathan and Nikita in 2006. I was hoping that Nikita will discuss this, but because at least I don't understand it. This looks very complicated and has not been used in actual computations. But now, given that the issue is really singularities as lambda lambda bar go to zero, a different approach would be to modify the gauge fixing condition from that one. So this condition really sets 11 components of lambda to zero. If you would find a way to modify this to be something like this, non-zero, then this pulse won't be a problem. However, this looks very hard, so we haven't really managed to do this. So since there's these issues with the genus greater than 2, we went back to the minimal formulation. So now let me tell you how the minimal formulation arises. So let's go back to this gauge fixed action again. So now I'm going to treat the spy fields differently. So far I said that the BRST auxiliary fields were identified with the non-minimal fields. So now let me parameterize the 11 independent components with some matrices C. So now if I integrate out this, so this are my 11 components, and then this is some rank 11 matrices. So now if I integrate out the pies, I get out 11 insertions of these guys from over here. So this is precisely the level picture lowering operators YC that we've seen in the beginning of the talk. So similarly, we can parameterize the 10G dependent components of pi and pi tilde, introducing a matrix, an antisymmetric matrix B mu nu. And then integrating those out, one gets 11G insertions of that type. So these are more than we've seen in the beginning of the talk. But it still remains to discuss the composite field G. So we need to solve this equation. And since we now have at our disposal constant tensors, there is a way to solve that equation, which is already known for 8-9 years now. So this is a solution where this G alpha is some known expression. So that's the solution of this equation. So one could try to use this one. But this solution is not acceptable for the same reason that we've seen earlier about the singularities as lambda lambda bar go to zero. And the reason is that if you allow for such behavior, again, all QS closed vertex operators would be exact, because this one can construct disk size that satisfy this relation. And a related issue is that the positions of the poles of this G over here coincides with the positions of the zeros of the path integral insertions. Therefore, this looks like it's ill-defined. So again, to deal with this, we can go back and observe that the equation is actually defines a cohomology class. And then the question is whether within the cohomology class there exists a different representative such that the poles of the new G would cancel against the zeros in the path integral. And indeed, one can find such a representative. Let's call it G1. And this G1 is given by the previous B, namely the one that solved this equation, divided by this picture-changing operator. And if we reshuffle this equation, we get it to be of that form, which is exactly what say Nathan solved in 2004. And one can check that this G1 indeed represents the same cohomology class as G0. So then we're meant to divide the amplitude by a number of this picture-changing operators, and this changes the number to the one that was originally introduced by Nathan. So combining all of these ingredients, we get the scattering amplitude prescription in the minimal formulation. So in this case, the B field is complicated. I mean, if I would write it down, it would probably fill 2-3 slides. But it is explicitly known. It has no pulses lambda go to zero. So at least at the face of it, it appears to give a prescription which is well-defined everywhere for any genus G surface. So this was the reason we went back to that, because the non-minimal ones seem to have a problem from genus greater than 2, but at the face of it, this didn't seem to have any problem. However, as I will see in the rest of this talk, there are actually BRST anomalies, because QS exact states actually do not decouple. So next I'm going to describe that. Any questions? So this kind of finishes the discussion of the derivation of the prescriptions.
The QS plus QV is the exact states decouple, or there's no QV anymore?
is not QV anymore. So now I've done the quantization, and then I forget about
this
it.
B is just corresponds to just the G alpha field in the.
Yes.
So you don't take into account the G alpha, the alpha beta gamma, alpha beta gamma delta corrections.
So the no. I do take into account those. I do take into account those. Yeah. Okay, so now to define the minimal scattering amplitudes, we need to apply constant tensors C alpha and B. And since this enters through a gauge fixing condition, it seems reasonable that no physical quantity would depend on them. And in particular, the theory should still be Lorentz invariant. So at tree level, we just need to choose 11 independent tensors, spinors C alpha. And a convenient way to do this is to observe that the Wald spinor decomposes under SU5 into 1 plus 10 plus 5. So we can take, so for each of the spinors, we just choose one of these directions. For instance, for the first one, it is non-zero in one direction, and in the remaining 10, there are non-zero in the 10 direction. So that's one choice. And we choose all the other C's to be zero. So that's a choice. Okay, so now let's try to compute a simple amplitude. For instance, the three-point function of a gauge boson with the gluiness. So that's the computation we need to do. We need 11 of those, and these are done using inputting the C's. Yes.
If you do a Lorentz variation of the B field, it's BST invariant, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So the problem doesn't come from there.
It's not from the B, no. I will explain where the problem comes. So if you compute this, you just find this answer, and this is not what you expect. You expect that this answer over here, and this is just a piece of it. So it's clearly not using this prescription, you don't get the Lorentz invariant answer. But then once you see this, then you ask, are they actually, so the amplitudes are formally independent of C, but is this really true? So let's see why that's true. So let's shift one of the C's and see what happens. So if we shift, let's say, the 11C in this manner, then the variation of the picture changing operator is Q exact, so you would expect nothing will happen. But now let's compute it. So we put this in here. Again, it's a three-level computation, and that's the answer, and this is non-zero. So this clearly depends on the C's.
That choice of C is singular.
All choices of C. This choice of C is singular. Here I shifted it, but there is no. Actually, when we first found the issue, we did try to see whether there exist another choices, whether there is a subclass of choices of C that would make things okay, and there is no choice of C which makes things okay. So the gauge fixing condition imposes, it's the condition C alpha lambda alpha equals zero.
So the one you chose.
So the one I chose, actually you will see it in a minute what it is. The ones I chose means that if I write the spinor in U5 variables, all of this are zero. And that's precisely the wrong, let's say, the bad point in the space of pure spinors. So the anomaly that we will find is, I think, very closely related to the anomaly in the space of pure spinors, and it's really this issue. But I don't think that the non-minimal does particularly better, and I will discuss this towards the end.
This is the choice for what?
This is the gauge choice for the zero, for the gauge invariance due to zero mode.
What is the generator of the invariance? What is the generator?
So you shift the lambda by its zero mode.
There's no such symmetry that shifts. The only symmetries of the lambda space are the dilatations and the SL10 rotation.
I have a worksheet theory, right? Then I can take, I can shift lambda in that action by zero mode, and the action would be invariant. I can write down that transformation. And in terms of
lambda, take place in a nonlinear space. You cannot just shift things.
No, sure. So I first go to the U5 variables where the watch theory becomes. This is only valid in certain parts. So all the problems I really go back to this problem that this point should be excised, and the actual prescription just put the theory in that bad point. That's where all the problems come from, and I don't know how to put the theory elsewhere.
No,
the prescription of the amplitude. Forget how I derive this, right? Forget how I derive this. And now I just use the prescription as given by Nathan in 2004, and I find this, right? Forget how this came. Forget my derivation. From the pragmatic point of view, if you try to do a computation, you find a non-zero answer where it should be zero. But let me move on, and I will explain a bit more, and then we return to discuss. Yes.
Can you say like C alpha lambda alpha equals one? Like that's what you get from the spring embedding, I think, or something like. Right.
So I did try to. I did try to choose something different, and I just wasn't able. So this doesn't mean it's not possible. But no simple choices. I mean, at the end of the day, you just, you know, this is a linear system, right? So after you write it in your five variables, and then the question whether there is a non-zero answer depends on the, let's say, whether these equations are linearly independent or not. So you can really analyze that.
You remember, like, Mario, like, had this Y formalism, blah, blah, blah. So that's like.
The Y formalism, it's, yeah. This is compatible with the Y formalism. It's not.
No, but you get a different condition, maybe. No?
You don't get the different.
You don't know.
No, it's the same. So now, to understand the origin of the problem, let's go back, and I want to tell you a little bit about the pure spinor integration measure. So this was derived again by Nathan in 2004, and has this form, where this is a specific invariant tensor constructed out of gamma matrices. But now, if we go to U5 variables, this takes this very simple form. So we have, this is this lambda plus direction. These are lying the 10. And there is a denominator over here with a lambda plus to the third. And it's really this factor that creates the problem. So let's see why it creates this problem. So the picture changing operator is formally QS closed. But because of this pulse in the measure, they're actually not closed inside correlators. So let's see how this comes about. So if we have QS on YC, we get this answer, which is zero because it's delta of X times X. Or if to see it more explicitly, if we choose the C alpha plus to be just delta alpha plus, we get lambda plus times delta lambda plus. So that would be zero if the remaining expression was polynomial lambda plus. But precisely because we have that factor, we get a non-zero answer. That's really the origin. So, of course, at tree level, I mean, this is a too easy computation to be missed, right? I mean, when Nathan wrote his paper in 2004, he did reproduce the tree level amplitudes. So how did this go about? So the way the prescription was presented in 2004 involved an additional step. And the argument was that since the amplitude is formally independent of C, one can integrate over C. So this step clearly manifestly restores Lorentz invariance, but has the additional bonus that now BRST exact states do decouple. However, since the amplitudes do depend on the choice of C, so such a procedure is questionable. The argument for doing this was that this amplitude was not depending on C.
So, yeah. You chose a C which is singular on some patches. That should be.
And I'm saying all choices of C are singular in the patch. Well, you know, it's that you can show me some.
Okay, you can't choose it in such a simple way.
But I mean, I shifted this choice of C, right? And I show you that the answer.
Okay, so let me try to explain. There's a choice of lambda, such that lambda gamma C. You chose C such that five of the components the type. So does the, let me call lambda bar something with the operator.
Yes. So I did try to impose the condition that, let's say, one of the or all of the fives are zero and then another six. And then at the end, it returns back to the same condition.
So C is special. You agree. It's not the generic.
No, I don't agree with this. I agree that I say that all other choices would return back.
Let me try to explain why your C is special. So suppose I choose a pure spinner lambda bar with the opposite chirality from lambda. There's a choice of lambda bar such that lambda bar again C is zero for all, right? Because... So suppose I choose lambda bar to be...
I think that's a technical point that we can discuss. We can discuss. I mean, yeah, maybe there is a subclass of Cs, but I don't think that would remove...
A special C that is not valid on all patches. I think there are choices.
So...
I don't say all on the same orbital.
Right. But actually, okay, in this slide, in the next slides, I'm going to present a picture changing operator which are manifestly Lorentz invariant. So whatever the C is, we have to be of that form because this is a unique choice. Actually, this agrees with integrating over the Cs. Yeah. Okay, so. So we've seen here that if you do this step, if you integrate over the Cs, the problems go away. And one can ask, why did the problems go away? And the reason the problems went away is because there is a way to have a manifestly Lorentz invariant prescription, which is the one I give over here, where this lambdas, alpha, beta, gamma, are defined by this equation. Now, it turns out that there is a unique choice of a Lorentz covariant tensor that satisfies this integral equation. And this unique choice is the one which you start from the lambda plus plus given by this string of delta functions, and then you act with Lorentz generators. Now, if you start from this three-level amplitude, then one can prove that QS exact phase decoupled is manifestly Lorentz invariant. And then one can show that this prescription is equivalent to integrating over the Cs. So this was the reason this worked, because there's a unique way to impose Lorentz invariance.
So why didn't you give the explicit lambda, alpha, beta, gamma?
I did, why did I give them explicitly?
So you said there is unique such tensor, but you didn't write down the tensor, you just wrote down it is given by. Is there a reason why you didn't write down the tensor?
Here it is, right? I can act one out with the answer on
that.
Yeah,
that's what I'm asking. If you act, then get the answer. What does the answer look like? Is there a reason why you didn't give us that?
No, there's no reason except that I don't have a very neat formula. I have a formula with commutators that I can work out
going your order. Oh, so you just haven't worked it out.
I haven't worked out all components, but I know there is unique using group theory arguments.
When you take this tensor, then you average over the SO tensor?
This is equivalent, so this tends to be equivalent with integrating over the state.
When you say that all components are taken by acting with the Lorentz generators, does it mean that you take this expression and average over SO tensor?
I wouldn't call it average, just say act. So for instance, if I want, let me give you an example. So I want to construct this component. This is going to be this Lorentz generator acting on that. So this is an SO, this is a 10 index. So I just compute this commutator. We actually do. We are going to give in the paper the first few components, but there is a group theory argument that there's only one such tensor that satisfies this integral equation. The second term over here, the meaning of this term is that it imposes that this is gamma matrix traceless, the right-hand side. But I mean, at the end of the day, it is the same with what you're saying, because integrating over the Cs is like averaging through the...
danger that you get zero.
Yeah, so this one is not zero, right? Because we explicitly constructed at least one component. Sure, yeah.
You start acting with n's and then you can come back and so it will cancel. It might
not. No. This is the highest weight component.
So it will never come back.
It never come back. So it's really, so we check it's a real representation and we check it's non-zero. Okay, so at one loop, at the end of the day, it looked okay. I mean, I you know, there was a problem, but one could solve it either by averaging or using this Lorentz invariant picture-changing operators. So now let's go one to one loop to see whether this, let's say, would-be problems are not real problems. So at one loop, there are new features, so we need to insert new picture changing operators, and we need to use the composite B field. And both of these involve a choice of the constant B tensor. So we have to, so let's choose some Bs and see whether the amplitudes are Lorentz invariant and whether Bs the exact terms decouple. So that's what we want to compute. So we insert one Bs the exact state. We have n minus one other insertions. So there is the B field. Then these are the ZB insertions. And these are the, in a sense, the Y insertions, which I now replace them with the Lorentz invariant version. So now from this expression, using the standard argument, one can move Q from here to act on the remaining parts. So this is BRST close, nothing happens. If it hits that one, this gives a total derivative in moduli space. So there could be such an anomaly there, but this is not the point of this computation. If it acts here, it gives nothing. So the only non-zero, so the anomaly we're going to find is when it hits this theta over here, when it hits the YCs again. So here is now again a choice. We make some explicit choice. So then it turns out that all one loop amplitudes with one BRST the exact term turn out to be proportional to that expression. And in this form, it becomes apparent that the problem that we find at three level just becomes worse at loop orders, because now we have even higher powers of lambda plus in the denominator. So that integral, so the heart of the paper is really computing this integral. So this integral turns out to be non-zero, and that's where the anomaly comes from.
This is before integrating out over tau?
This is before integrating out over tau. No, because, well, it does, because integrating over tau would, you know, get rid of the total derivative when Q acts on this B. So this really comes from QS acting on picture-changing operators. So these terms are formally zero by themselves. Really, it's really because, yeah, this had to be zero by itself. It's not special, because I can, yeah. And actually, you would see that when I, let's say, integrate over the Bs, I still get an anomaly. But let me. Okay, so now we got this. Okay, this integral is non-zero, but one could say, okay, maybe this is going to cancel by yet some other miraculous cancellation if I keep doing other integrals. Here, I just did the lambda integrals. It should have been zero with the lambda integrals, because this picture changing operators are meant to be Q exacts on that sector. But let's see what happens if we start integrating. So if we go to 4 points, one loop amplitudes, with one BRST exact state, so this turns out that it is zero after we do the de-integration. So that's why there have been explicit 4-point amplitudes, and the results agree exactly with RNS. Okay, that's the reason. In this case, it's really accidental, because this kind of cancellation is really special to 4-point functions. This doesn't happen for 5-point functions. And furthermore, if we do the Lorentz variation of this 4-point one loop amplitudes, we also get a non-zero answer. It's also non-Lorentz invariant. But again, this computation was done with some specific choice of B. So what happens if we actually integrate over B? Since, okay, we've seen earlier that we made a specific choice of C, there was something wrong, we integrate over this, things seem to be restored. So we've done this computation too. So for 4-point functions, it's exactly like here. The BRST exact states do decouple, and this follows from representation theory, namely the amplitude vanishes because a certain type of invariant tensor doesn't exist. But for 4-point functions, group theory alone does not imply a decouple of BRST exact states. So the same type of argument doesn't guarantee that this would vanish. Okay, so this was for the minimal one.
So you don't show that they don't decouple, you just don't have an argument.
Yeah, so there's no argument that they decouple, and you have to do some further integrals. And we haven't, let's say, done all integrations. We haven't done all
Vintage grid over the margins of the torus.
But I don't think that this plays any role in this case. Because this doesn't come, it's not a usual anomaly that comes because you hit the B and the B gives you total derivative in moduli space. This is the usual story of BRST anomalies. This comes because Q of YC was lambda plus delta lambda plus, and this meant to be zero. I mean, this should have been zero identically, right? This should have been zero identically. This should have been zero identically here. QS of YC, this picture changing operator. Let's see how it works for the non-minimal one. But don't you agree that when I partially integrate this, I can get total derivatives when I hit that one. But when I hit all the picture changing operators, that should be zero. There's not a total derivative. There's no formal argument that says this is a total derivative.
Sorry, I'm just used to the fact that Q can hit on B tilde and change it to a T, and that gives you a total.
Absolutely. So this is still there. There may be additional anomalies. There may be additional anomalies because of that. These are not the ones I'm discussing.
I don't understand why they're not related, but maybe.
Okay, so we've seen the minimal version had an anomaly. What about the non-minimal one? Is it possible that this could have similar problems? So in the minimal case, the problems were really coming from QS variations of the picture changing operators. And in the non-minimal version, this is replaced by that factor. But in this case, there's really nothing subtle with this factor. So when we do the QS variation of that factor, we get one insertion minus the same insertion, and same for the dots. So in this case, at least at the face of it, doesn't seem to be a problem. So the only issue is whether there would be other infinities that would invalidate this argument. So to check this, we computed just half of this amplitude. So we just pick this piece over here, or the analog for the one loop. And we want to see whether that piece is infinite, because if there would be infinite, then it would be infinity minus infinity, there would be a possibility of an anomaly. But it turns out this doesn't happen. So in the non-minimal case, there is no anomaly. However, the amplitude still behave differently depending on whether the minimal computation is anomalous or not. And this is how they behave. So if there is a BRST anomaly in the minimal version, like for five-point functions, each piece is finite by itself in the non-minimal version, so you need to subtract to get zero. But if in the minimal case the group theory implied decoupling, like for four-point functions, then in this case, each piece vanishes separately for the same group theory reason. So in a sense, you get a double zero. You get zero minus zero. While for the other cases, you get finite minus finite. So in the non-minimal version, all BSD exact terms indeed do decouple. So now let me summarize, and then I will have a couple of more slides trying to explain a little bit more the relation between minimal and non-minimal in a toy example, and then we finish. So what I've done here, I presented the first principle derivation of the scattering amplitude prescriptions for the pure spin or superstring. And formally, these are equivalent because the only difference was, you know, how I treat the auxiliary fields. However, the minimal formulation suffers from BRST anomalies. Now, from the way the three-level computations, the three-level solution indicates that there may be a different way to do the one-loop computation, sort of a new minimal version, which doesn't suffer from these anomalies, and we do have indications that this is possible at one-loop order, and, you know, hopefully at higher loop orders. If this does work, this would give a way to do scattering up to computation to all orders. So, that's what we're doing currently. So any questions before I give you my toy example? OK. Okay, so now let me give you an analogy. So one can describe the relation between the minimal and the non-minimal formalisms using the following elementary example. So consider that we have complex x and p, and consider the following integral, where we integrate over the real axis of x and p. So if we first do this, then we get the delta function, and then this gives delta of 0. So this is the minimal formulation. Now one can start from that expression and then rotate the contours so that p becomes ix star. And then we get this line over here, which can be rewritten like that one. So these two would be equivalent if there are no poles encountered when we rotate the contour. Or, you know, if this f of x that I have over here is non-singular. If this is singular, so if they're non-singular, it would be manifestly the same. But if they're singular, they can be different. So a simple example is to choose f of x to be equals to 1 over x. Clearly, the first one gives infinity, but the second one gives 0. So even though these are formally the same, in reality, because of additional poles, they're different. One can be anomalous while the other is not. And that's precisely what seems to be happening in the non-minimal and the minimal. Okay, so which questions I didn't answer? Yes.
So did you write both formalism and different gauge fixings?
It is really the same gauge fix. Actually, it's good that you're saying this. So the only difference is here. So suppose in this integral we excise the point x equals 0. That would give exactly identically equal result 0. Where over here, so it's really the same gauge fixing. It's the same gauge fixing function. The only difference is how you treat the auxiliary fields. So in this example, let's say the p is like my pi's and x is like the lambda. And the gauge fixing condition lambda equals 0 is reflected in the fact that this is linear in x. And here after I rotate, it's really the same gauge fixing condition. I just rotated the contours of integration. I haven't changed the gauge fixing. The problem comes from the analytic continuation and the fact that they are poles. So
what is this pole? I mean, what is precisely the source of the problem in
The singularity that you have in the measure, that let's say the pure spinner measure here have, let's say, d lambda, dx over x cubed.
That's the source of the problem.
Yeah. So if you write it in this language, this is less severe. And the reason it's less severe is the same reason as over here. You know, this function here behaves better in this weak rotated version than in this one. But ideally, what one would like to do is one would like to replace that part over here with x minus x naught squared. So one would like to have this. But that I don't know how to do.
You can't fix up the first one with some kind of I epsilon prescription?
You mean, why do you want me to put the I epsilon prescription?
Well, you put some of the x in the e to the ip, the usual thing when you say it's oscillating, so you put something like e to the ipx minus epsilon x squared minus epsilon p squared.
You mean to be able to deal with the singular f of x's?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's, yeah, maybe, it's yeah. I mean, I don't know.
So then maybe there's some analogous I epsilon prescription that works for the minimal?
I think this thing, now that one understands the relation, is worth exploring on different gauge fixings, because I think all the problems really come from the fact that this prescription just put the theory at the wrong point, just put the theory where it's anomalous, both the minimal and the non-minimal one.
If it's a singular gauge fixing, I don't know the word anomalous, right? You don't say anomaly,
but there is no other known way to gauge fix. I think it's an illegal gauge. If you do this gauge fixing,
You just wrote another gauge fix. You said the non-minimal is okay. That's another gauge fix.
It's not another gauge fix, it's just the rotation from here to there. It's the same gauge fixing. I think that's why there are problems when you with a B field, that with a pulse lambda lambda bar is about to zero.
Do you think the non-minimal is the same string theory gauge
fix? It comes from, it's, the relation is really exactly the same as here. So minimal is like this, and non-minimal is like that one. It's the same function, we just rotate B to BIX star.
You're not saying they're two different gauge fixings.
They're not the different gauge fixings. It's the same gauge fixing treated differently. You weak rotate in filled space. But there are singularities as you weak rotate. I mean, I would have liked to have a different gauge fixing, either the one or the other, where you're not sitting exactly at the wrong point. With a non-minimal one, you seem to kind of put a Gaussian. So it's centered, there is a Gaussian center around the wrong point, but it's still centered in the wrong point. It would be nice to be centered somewhere else. But if one takes, let's say, the minimal formalism at phase value, then there is an anomaly. Irrespective of how you do it, whether you like my choices of Bs, you can do it by integrating over the Bs and the Cs, like we did for the five-point function.
You didn't show the five-point function was incorrect.
You couldn't show the fit supposed to couple, but if I said the Bs were over the lines of the choice, I don't think any couple is going to change.
But I mean, that part of the...